Morning. We will now hear our second case today, 11AP 2067, Mary E. Marlowe versus IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. I'm going to read the lineup so we're sure we agree before we begin. Mr. Tease will, representing Mary Marlowe, will have 25 minutes. Mr. Kahns, representing IDS Property, will have 25 minutes. And then Dustin Brown, representing the Amicus, will have 5 minutes. This is the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, which gives the IDS 30 minutes. And then Mr. Tease will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Agreed? Okay. Attorney Tease, representing the Marlowes, may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Ralph Tease, and along with my partner, Rhonda Lanford, we represent Mary and Leslie Marlowe in this matter. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision because it undercuts the public policy of arbitration in this state. And it grants authority to an arbitration panel where this court previously in Borst v. Allstate has already ruled that it has no authority. As to my first point, everybody involved in the litigation, civil litigation process in this state, from this court down to the individual litigants, understands the benefits of alternative dispute resolution procedures in lieu of complex, costly, and time-consuming circuit court litigation. Our entire court system has benefited to the extent that arbitration has allowed for some civil disputes to proceed without the need for burdening our circuit courts. Likewise, by providing litigants with an alternative means of resolving their civil disputes without consuming years of time and tens of thousands of dollars in litigation expense, indicates that litigants have also directly benefited from the use of arbitration in this state. Fortunately for Wisconsin, this court has had a long-standing policy of encouraging arbitration as an alternative to litigation. In fact, in Borst v. Allstate, this court identified the goals of arbitration as follows: to resolve the entire controversy out of court without the formality and expense that normally attaches to a circuit court action. But at the same time in Borst, this court also warned that allowing unfettered discovery in arbitration is contrary to those goals. It's for that reason that this court has held that the general rule is that parties to arbitration processes will not be allowed to conduct discovery beyond that provided under Chapter 788 of the Wisconsin statutes unless there's an express agreement to the contrary. In other words, the general rule of no discovery will control unless there's a clear indication that the parties to the arbitration process have expressly agreed to opt out of the general rule of no discovery.
Mr. Tease, let me, if I might interrupt for a minute. In this particular case, it's my understanding that there is reference in the agreement in regard to arbitration to local rules. What do you think that means?
Well, I think that's the entire issue in this case as to whether that means what IDS suggests and that it arguably refers to discovery, or whether it means something else. Our position is that if you take a look at the arbitration provision in the policy, there are three numbered paragraphs in that arbitration provision. The language local rules appears in the third paragraph, which relates to the hearing itself, not to pre-hearing discovery. In that third paragraph, it tells you where the arbitration is to take place. It tells you what the issues at the hearing are to be. And it tells you what the rules of law as to procedure and evidence will be, and in this case, local rules. So our position is that that particular clause clearly relates only to the hearing process itself based on its language and based on its placement in the policy.
Well, now, it's my understanding that the circuit court found that local rules was somewhat ambiguous, and because of that, the court held against the drafter, the insurance company. Is that your position also?
Well, the Court of Appeals decision latches on to two things. One, it says that that language arguably refers to the scope of discovery, which we think is contrary to the directive in Borse, where you need a clearly express agreement. But the Court of Appeals also seems to latch on to the fact that the phrase is ambiguous, at least to its context. And what they say then is that if it's ambiguous, then it can arguably be interpreted to refer to discovery. In this case, we have IDS, who has argued at every level of this case that that language essentially gives them the right to Chapter 804 discovery. We know that the trial court said that it more likely relates to Chapter 788, which is the Wisconsin Arbitration Act, because, in fact, this is an arbitration and not a circuit court action. And if you look at the 80101 sub 2 of the Wisconsin Rules of Civil Procedure, it actually contains a provision there that says that the rules of civil procedure, which include Chapter 804, are meant to only control circuit court actions in the courts in the state, not arbitration proceedings.
Counselor, you know, I was a little bit surprised when I read your brief. You argue to us there, as you do now, and I'm looking at page 198 of your appendix, and it's subsection 3 that talks about arbitration, and it has the phrase, local rules of law as to procedure and evidence will apply, and you argue to us that's involving the actual hearing that's going to go on. I was kind of surprised you didn't talk about the Brown County local rules, and I got them out, and they have local rules on how hearings are conducted, but you didn't talk about them, and your opposing counsel didn't talk about them. Is there some reason that local rules, which is how it's labeled on top of the Brown County rules, some reason why you don't think that that's what it was referring to, or why you are not employing that?
That is a great question, because it raises another level of ambiguity in this clause. Does it mean the local Brown County court rules? Does it mean Chapter 804? Does it mean Chapter 788, which does have some discovery provisions, as the trial court indicated in this case, it provides for limited depositions? Or does it mean, as we all know through our years of practice in arbitration, that there are many, many unwritten local rules, such as the fact that you don't necessarily have to have a doctor testify live, a medical report will do. There are many different levels that would indicate that this language in its context and phrasing in this clause is ambiguous to some extent. And the point of all of that is that if you have a clause, if the Court of Appeals is saying that this clause arguably refers to the scope of discovery, or it's ambiguous and should be interpreted to arguably refer to it, then we clearly don't have a clearly drafted, detailed document. Clearly drafted were words of Borse. You cannot have a clearly drafted agreement that contains ambiguous clauses by definition. It doesn't make any sense. So the fact that we have the ambiguity indicates, I think, it's an admission that, in fact, this doesn't meet the directives of this court in Borse v. Allstate.
I have a question as to just what's involved here. In the policy, in the first page, 190, it says that the insured, any person seeking any coverage must, right, cooperate in the investigation, settlement, or defense. Does that cover? Does two cover arbitration? So any person seeking coverage, that's the Marlowe seeking coverage under the uninsured. That's one way of reading it. And so the Marlowe's have to submit as often as we reasonably require to physical exams. Did they ever do that?
No, other than through the arbitration process, no request was ever made for that.
No request was made. And no request to answer under oath until we get to arbitration.
Right, and they were, and IDS was offered a deposition of our client.
And D says that a person seeking coverage must authorize us to obtain medical reports. Did they do that?
Yes, our medical reports were provided to IDS and as part of the arbitration process, an offer was made to supplement and increase the scope of those records.
So what is it they want that you're not willing to give them?
Well, they want the whole gamut of Chapter 804 discovery, which would include interrogatories, requests for production of documents, depositions of not only our client, but of others that could include treating doctors, the uninsured driver. They're looking for that type of discovery. They also made a request that if the issues arose, that they would want not only a defense medical examination, but perhaps a vocational evaluation as well. And, of course, all of those steps in the discovery process are not only time-consuming, but they can be extremely costly, especially if it leads to the need for more depositions of us taking depositions of defense experts.
Well, if they don't have this kind of information, then how can they determine whether your client is legally entitled to recover and the amount?
How can IDS make that determination?
How can the arbitrators make the determination?
Well, of course, the arbitrators, as a trier of the fact, they're going to make a determination based on the evidence that is presented to them.
Oh, so they're going to take the driver's testimony, your insured's testimony, and any wells you call or they call.
Right.
Without discovery.
And there's nothing to prevent either side from calling witnesses to the hearing, questioning them, cross-examining witnesses under oath, subpoenaing records to the hearing. That is not discovery. That's part of the hearing process itself.
So you don't object to them getting any of that evidence during the hearing, except if there are other objections, but that's part of the hearing, so they can get all the evidence, theoretically. But the only thing you're objecting to is advance of hearing discovery.
That's exactly right.
And that's where much of the costs of trials come in, of discovery, rather than in the good old days, I don't know, I put good in quotes and old in quotes, when you just went in and tried the darn case.
Well, in this case, because IDS would have the benefit of what the insurance policy requires our client to turn over, it would have the benefit of whatever limited discovery is allowable under Chapter 788. Mm-hmm. In addition, there are practices generally where there can be pre-hearing disclosures of exhibits and documents and records that either side is going to use at the hearing, which would further enlighten them as to what the issues would be and what witnesses they would need at the hearing. So there's ample opportunity for both sides to exchange information, but it has to be contained in the policy itself, or it has to be agreed to by the parties, or it has to be part of the arbitrator's process of controlling the hearing, just like a trial court might ask for an exchange of witness lists, exchange of exhibits before the date of the trial to expedite the hearing process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the key issues in this case, as I see it, is that the ordinary rule or concept is, okay, you guys picked arbitration, you're out of the court system. When you finally get the arbitrator's decision, you can come back into the court system under Chapter 788, but you get limited judicial review because you picked the system, you're stuck with it, and you're stuck with errors in the system. The stated broadly, what you're not stuck with is a very, very unfair kind of arbitration. I mean, that's not precise enough, but in essence, that's what's with us now. The arbitration has not been completed, right?
That's right.
You haven't won it. You haven't lost it. And so you come into court and say, whoa, we got to stop the arbitration proceedings because it's going off in the wrong direction. And we're going to be put to a lot of expense, which will not be reimbursed. And we may win it, we may lose it, but the real problem is the expense now. And that's just contrary to the whole concept of arbitration, which is where you began. So if we would hold in your favor and say you can, in effect, interrupt the arbitration proceeding by going to court, there'll be lots of other times where people are going to say, we've got to interrupt arbitration and keep getting court review. And that defeats one of the basic concepts of arbitration. So how do we balance, on the one hand, your right to arbitration free of a lot of expenses, and the other party's just right to arbitration and not court review?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and I think it was raised to some extent by the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance in its brief that this would open the floodgates of people running to the circuit courts. But our position is that Borst is very clear on what the directives of this court were if you wanted to have discovery and arbitration beyond Chapter 788. And since 2006, when Borst came down, there hasn't been a floodgate of cases coming to circuit court seeking review. So in this case, if this court can further clarify what its expectations are for parties if they want to conduct discovery in an arbitration proceeding beyond what you've even done in Borst, and then the parties adopt those suggestions and directions and have carefully drafted detailed agreements like Borst requires them to do, it's going to be very seldom that somebody is going to look at a well-drafted clear document and have a significant disagreement to the point where they're going to go to court, as we have done in this case, and challenged the initial authority of the arbitrators to determine the scope of discovery. It's a different matter to go to court at the end of the arbitration proceeding, as you've mentioned, and seek a limited review under Chapter 788. So I don't anticipate, as there hasn't been in the past, and I don't anticipate in the future after this case is decided, that there'll be any opportunity for an abundance of these types of cases to hit the circuit court, but none of us can predict what type of language in a document we may see someday, and certainly there can be legitimate disputes in an arbitration provision or any other contract between parties, and everyone would be entitled to go to circuit court under the Declaratory Judgment Act and seek relief. But with good direction from this court, most trial courts will make short work of that, and I think it will become very much of a self-correcting problem.
Mr. Keyes, doesn't the intermediate review approach run counter to the policy of arbitration that you started out telling us about this morning?
I think, again, to be clear, what the Court of Appeals did is they jumped over the requirements of Borst to get to the issue they really wanted this case to be about, and that was whether we were entitled to seek an intermediate review of the arbitrator's decision on the scope of discovery. And, of course, it's our position that we never sought that review because we took the position from day one that the arbitrators didn't have the authority to determine the scope of discovery so that there was nothing to review. Instead, it was a declaratory judgment on whether or not the policy language empowered the arbitrators or not. So what I see is an intermediate review would be an extremely limited circumstance, as is indicated in the case law cited by IDS and the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, which we agree with. If we're looking at intermediate reviews of arbitrators' decisions where they have the authority to act, either by statute or by agreement, if the arbitration process is going to work as a cost-effective and time-efficient alternative to circuit court litigation, then we have to put a limit on that type of review. But that's not what we were seeking here in this case.
You came in as a declaratory judgment action, declaratory relief action.
Right.
So are you saying that if it's a declaratory relief action to interpret the insurance policy, that is one of the exceptions to no intermediate review?
I don't think it's an exception to the rule on intermediate review. I think it's a whole separate breed of cats, so to speak, because what it is, it's unique. If there were cases in other jurisdictions that had decided an issue similar to what this court had done in Boris, I haven't seen it in any of the briefs that were written. But in Boris, this court, recognizing the importance of the public policy of encouraging arbitration versus litigation, what they did is they came up with essentially a decision that not only endorses it, but it gives an indication of how you can protect arbitration and how we can determine ways of keeping arbitration cost-effective and time-efficient. That is the authority part of the decision. Intermediate rulings are where the arbitrator has authority. We've agreed they have authority, and now we're challenging what they have done in their discretion, so to speak.
Why wouldn't it make at least some sense for the case to proceed through arbitration? Let's just say there's some discovery that has nothing to do with what the damage award should be, right? And shouldn't have happened, shouldn't have occurred. And if the arbitrators make the award based upon that inappropriate discovery, then that would be modified in the final award under 788.11 or the authority of the court. Kind of like the Orlowski case with the collateral source rule. When the arbitrators didn't follow the collateral source rule, it was modified, right? So if discovery proceeds and everything goes forward and they ask for something that's completely irrelevant or inappropriate to consider in awarding damages, why shouldn't that be the basis of a modification of the final award?
Well, I think that the uniqueness of this circumstance is that if we're talking about keeping arbitration as cost-effective and time-efficient, it means not only at the time of the hearing, it means pre-hearing as well. And if you wait until the end of the case to decide whether the arbitrators had the authority to order the discovery that was conducted, the time and money has already been spent. There's no meaningful remedy for a party who has been sucked into an arbitration process thinking it's going to be cost-effective to then have to engage in an abundance of pre-hearing discovery only to find out later that they really didn't have to do it because it's already water under the bridge.
Tell me what it is that would be so expensive and inefficient in the arbitration.
Well, there are two things. One is you can have, and again, keep in mind that this type, we're focusing here on the IDS policy, but Forest applies to arbitration clauses in all kinds of contracts, employment contracts, buy-sell agreements, whatever it may be. And so if there's a discovery that is undertaken, such as depositions that were unnecessary, let's say one side decided they're going to take 10 depositions and turned out later they weren't necessary, parties are going to have to pay attorney's fees to have their lawyers attend all of those depositions and prepare for them. You're going to have court reporter costs. You're going to have significant expenses, only to find out at the end of the arbitration hearing, oh, our mistake, they didn't have the authority to order any of that.
Let me ask you this. You think that the court can limit depositions in arbitration?
I think this court has. I think this court has clearly said in supporting the public policy of encouraging arbitration, I think this court has said that there is really no discovery beyond the limited depositions under Chapter 788 unless the parties agree expressly to the contrary. That is the mandate of the Boris decision.
Right, but I guess maybe I just read 788.07 differently. I didn't see in there that it was limited to a court determination of relevancy.
Of relevancy?
Right, or whatever. I mean, I didn't, because I just, I haven't, I no. didn't really envision that when someone notices up a dep in an arbitration, you can run off to court and say, well, I want to quash the notice because there's a limit in 788.07.
Well, the procedure in 788.07 does have some limiting factors because it has to be done upon a petition approved by the arbitrators, and then the court has to order or allow the depositions to proceed, assuming the parties don't agree to conduct the discovery. So I would assume that you would not have the arbitrators petitioning the court for a deposition that they've looked at and have deemed to not have anything to do with the issues in the lawsuit. I would hope they would do that.
Well, I'm trying to come up with a rule, if you were to succeed, that would narrow the review by courts while arbitration is proceeding, because that's very damaging to the arbitration. It stops it, got to start again, etc. So what about, can't be just because you are going to want to construe the insurance policy. That can happen a lot. And it would seem to be the goal of the court is to limit access to the court here once you choose arbitration. What about that you can seek a review if there's irreparable damage to the insured? And the irreparable damage here would be the cost of discovery, which you would not get back.
I see my time is up, but you are the Chief Justice, so I assume I can answer
that. I give the same leeway to all the justices, being fair, impartial, neutral, and nonpartisan that I am.
Okay, all right. I think that we could, and this court could fashion some remedies that might discourage people from willy-nilly seeking declaratory judgments on whether an arbitrator had the authority to order discovery. But I do, I sincerely think that if this court again clarifies and further directs people on what the expectations of this court is going to be, and then the parties that draft these and interpret these employ the language of the court's decision, that we're going to see very, very few competent, rational lawyers going to circuit court seeking this type of relief. Here we're dealing with a clause that was so obscure and ambiguous to the point that IDS even said on page 31 of their brief, that if they had lost the decision, they felt that they were going to have a right to come in for an intermediate review of the decision of the arbitrator. So it's almost like this type of clause is so far off the mark of what this court wanted in Boris that no matter who lost it, some circuit court was going to be hearing this issue. But I think, again, it's going to be a self-correcting issue because people are going to find out that, people can read an agreement and know what a good agreement looks like and what a carefully drafted document should contain.
So you'd add to my my quote rule of law about reviewing interlocutory review of a panel's intermediate decision that there's clear law on the issue. That would be Bost. Paragraphs 14 and 15 and even 16 of the Court of Appeals decision recognizes that federal cases have permitted, under certain circumstances, interlocutory review.
Right, under limited circumstances.
Right.
That's right. And we weren't seeking that, so we didn't attempt to even try to pigeonhole ourselves into one of those exceptional circumstances. That wasn't the issue.
Thank you,
may
counsel.
I,
yeah, Justice Prosser.
I'd like to follow up on a question that Justice Ziegler asked, and it has to do with the scope of depositions under the statute. I understood you to say that you were troubled by requests for depositions of, say, a doctor. Is that right?
Well, I was giving examples of the type of, in a case like this, you know, that you could have a doctor's deposition as one of many.
Okay. If I understand the statute, in order to get a deposition of a doctor, you would have to get the approval of the arbitrators.
That's the way I read chapter 788.07.
All right. And if you got the petition, the approval of the arbitrators, would you have the ability to subpoena documents, subpoena deuces tecum when the person shows up?
I would think if you could take the deposition, you could subpoena documents to be produced at the deposition. Just as you could, they could subpoena the doctor if they wanted. It would be an unfriendly circumstance, but they could subpoena the doctor to the hearing and have them produce records if they wanted to.
Well, isn't it less costly to just go after the records rather than subpoena the doctor to bring along the records?
Well, and that's the point. Most times arbitrations proceed just on the paper trail, but now we get into circumstances where they want to take language like this in a policy and say, well, we're not satisfied with the records. We want to go take depositions of all the treating doctors. You know, that means fees for the doctors. That means fees for the court reporters. That means attorney fees, an abundance of expenses that weren't contemplated when somebody opted for arbitration and gave up their right to go to a jury trial. So, yeah, certainly that's the circumstance.
Did I misunderstand that arbitrators authorized this kind of discovery?
In this case?
Yeah.
What the arbitrators in this case did is they essentially said you can employ discovery under Chapter 804, which, of course, would mean depositions of anybody along with all the other tools that are under that chapter.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Michael Kahns, representing IDS Property Casualty Insurance Company. Counsel.
May it please the court, the counsel for petitioner. I am Mike Kahns of the law firm of Gabert Williams, Kahns and Lorenk, located in Appleton. I'm here to represent the respondent, IDS Property and Casualty Insurance Company. I'm also here with my associate, Eric Fuhrer, who gets the credit for the research and writing in this matter, and with two other important people in my life, my father and my son. If I could have a minute, I'd like to recount a memory I had before I was, when I was considering going into law school about 28 years ago. I was a member, and I'm sure there are many of these yet today, of the Pre-Law Society at Marquette, which was a group, a club, for those interested in finding more out about the law and whether or not they were interested in pursuing a degree in the law.
And on a cold Saturday morning in Milwaukee one morning when I was a senior in college, the club would invite different speakers in to come and speak. One of the speakers was a noted criminal defense lawyer by the name of Steve Glenn. And Attorney Glenn gave a very compelling speech. And 28 years later, what I still remember about that speech, I think, is poignant for today's argument. And that is, his point, as I recall it, was the law is a search for the truth. And what could be more applicable in a case like this, a personal injury case where someone wants fair compensation for an injury, than to try to seek the truth? And the truth requires accuracy. And in order to obtain accuracy, you need to get accurate information. How I see this case, how it developed, what brought us here today, is that my client's request to obtain information, to seek the truth, to obtain accuracy in hopefully coming to a fair resolution of this case, has been thwarted at multiple steps. And I think thwarted not only in view of having to go through the procedures that we have, but it's been thwarted in terms of their own insurance policy. The insurance policy, as you've all read and indicate, does say that the insured has to cooperate. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, appear for medical examinations, produce records, etc. The policy goes on in a situation like this where you have an uninsured motorist claim to provide for arbitration.
Have they satisfied that first part of the policy?
The cooperation? Well, Justice Abrahamson, that was an issue that was raised in the letter briefs that were brought to the attention of the arbitration panel. We had raised the fact that they were refusing to allow discovery and actually
discovery is something else. The policy says nothing about discovery. It says that you got to go to the doctor, got to release your reports, and you got to cooperate. It doesn't say you have to have discovery. That isn't in the policy.
So the question here is whether the insured has cooperated with?
Yeah. Doesn't mean they have to do everything you want.
Well,
agree to discovery.
We are in arbitration, and I am certain, given what has been requested already, that had a medical examination been asked for, it would have been refused. And the grounds for that would have been that's part of Chapter 804 with stats, and the policy doesn't specifically mention in Chapter 804 with stats, so you're not entitled to it.
What import does 788.07, which does specifically speak to discovery, have, in your opinion, on this case? We just read it out because of the contract provision? Is that kind of where you are?
Excellent question, Justice Rogenczak. Chapter 788, I believe, and as stated in the Borst decision, is there if the policy is silent with respect to discovery or what a litigant's, a party's right is during the arbitration itself. So had our policy, the IDS policy, not indicated that it was subject to local rules of law concerning evidence and procedure, then I think 788, Chapter 788, would be your fallback. That's all you're entitled to under the law.
I will ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel, because as I read your briefs, I was surprised nobody talked about it. The phrase that's in the policy is local rules of law as to procedure and evidence will apply. Now, there are local rules in Brown County, and you didn't talk about them, but I got them, and I read them. Why isn't that what we should be looking at here instead of Chapter 804, 806, whatever discovery chapters you're going to end up with?
That piqued my interest when you asked opposing counsel that question. In fact, if you look at the supplemental decision of the arbitration panel, they did in fact address that issue because it was one of the arguments raised in the letter briefs by the Marlowe's attorney that how do we know what local rules refer to? Could it have been the Brown County Circuit Court rules?
Before that, you know, they're talking about the county in which the insured lives. So both parties agree that the arbitration will take place in the county in which the insured lives. Well, you're in Brown County, and then the next thing it says, local rules of law as to procedure and evidence apply. So when I read that and after reading your briefs, I thought, well, you know, why aren't we looking at the Brown County rules? But neither of you talked about them. So I thought, well, sometimes I get a bee in my bonnet. It's not in anybody else's bonnet because it doesn't make a doggone bit of difference. But it's still there, obviously, today. So I'm just wondering why I shouldn't be looking at that and thinking about those local rules as we decide about this case.
I believe that through attrition, a number of arguments were made initially before the arbitration panel. They were honed down to the one or two that we're addressing here today. That argument has fallen by the wayside. But I would just state that I'm in agreement with what the arbitration panel said, and that was, you know, local court rules in different counties, maybe all counties have them, are really meant to supplement the rules of procedure and evidence, not to contravene them.
No, they can't contravene them. I think you wouldn't get an argument from anybody about that. And I wasn't looking at them in regard to contravening. I was just looking at them and trying to interpret the contract because that's where the arbitrator, that's where his authority comes from. So I was trying to figure out, well, what did the contract mean? That's all.
Well, the contracts are interpreted, of course, not only through their writing, but through statutes and case law. And the Lukowski case, which I believe was cited in the Boris decision, it doesn't focus on it really, but it has the same language. It talks about local rules of procedure and evidence. And what was interesting, at least in my reading of that case, was I think it was implied to everyone that what they're talking about is the state of Wisconsin law, because that was a state case, regarding discovery and evidence.
Okay. Would you grant that provision in the policy, local court rules, that is, local rules of law as to procedure and evidence will apply, would you grant that that language is at least ambiguous?
I knew that question would be asked, and my response is, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder, but I can say this. At least according to the arbitration panel, three attorneys, and I think it's notable that the attorneys, two of them are selected by the litigants, and a third was selected.
So the answer to my question is what?
I don't believe it's ambiguous, Sean.
So interpreting this to mean local Brown County rules is an unreasonable interpretation. Is that correct?
I would have to say yes.
And interpreting this to refer only to Chapter 788 discovery is incorrect, or is unreasonable. Is that correct?
Again, I would agree with that statement. However, the second issue that follows your question is this. If it is ambiguous, and other courts' published decisions have called similar language ambiguous, then the question becomes, who decides that? And here, that's one of the main issues of why we're here. Is it the arbitration panel? Do they have exclusive authority when there is an ambiguity?
So your position is the only reasonable interpretation, the exclusive interpretation of local rules of law as to procedure and evidence means Chapter 804. That's your argument. Is that correct?
Well, I think you've extended it a little bit further than I would.
Okay. Let me take out exclusive and just stay with reasonable. It's the only reasonable interpretation, because if there are more than one reasonable interpretation, then it's ambiguous. So it's your position is the only reasonable interpretation. Is that correct?
My position is that it's clear that that's what would be referred to. And if you look at the history of Wisconsin case law, that's what they refer to.
And so I hear you saying it's the only reasonable interpretation. You're not. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're saying there are other reasonable interpretations.
I do not take issue with other courts and counsel representing the Marlowes that there can be other interpretations. In fact, I think the Court of Appeals decision in this case indicated that it was subject to more than one interpretation, as did the arbitration panel. But when you look back beyond what's written in the policy, if you look at the case law and the statutes, you look at the Lukowski decision, I think it becomes clear that what is referred to is the Wisconsin rules for evidence and procedure.
And so what I hear you saying then is that maybe it is ambiguous, but then we apply certain tools to discern the intents of the parties, and that we look to case law and other things to discern what the parties intended. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that if someone finds that language ambiguous, then the question is, who has authority to decide that?
What about the adage of, if especially in contracts of adhesion, that ambiguity is drafted, interpreted, or construed against the drafter? Does that come into play at all in this case, if it's interpreted or construed against the position of the drafter?
That's a very well-known canon of contract construction in Wisconsin. I don't disagree with that. I think the real issue is when that issue comes to the forefront, who has the authority to decide it? Is it the circuit court, or is it, as the parties have requested, the arbitration panel? And I think the law is clear from Wisconsin and many other federal cases that questions like this, so long as the policy has some language that needs to be interpreted, it's not devoid of any language about what the rules are, as long as there's some language that needs to be interpreted, it's the exclusive province of the arbitration panel, because that's what we asked for.
Why? This, just help me with this final question. If it is ambiguous, then why isn't that good old rule of contract interpretation applied?
Well, I can answer that this way. That is one of many rules of contract construction, as the court well knows. Other rules, canons of contract construction, which are just as well known and relied upon, is that you shouldn't construe something to come up with an absurd result, or something that wasn't in the reasonable contemplation of the parties, or, and I can go on and on, but it's one rule of construction, and then the question becomes, who's to interpret that rule?
Well, do the arbitrators have authority to just apply the wrong rule of law? Borst says it's got to be clear, precise, explicit in the contract. I mean, it's hard to say, even if you're willing to say this is unambiguous, it's hard to say that it's clear, precise, and explicit that you can have discovery, right?
That you're going to have to, I'm sorry?
Have discovery. The word discovery doesn't appear.
No, it doesn't. And this was an argument raised in letter briefs to the arbitration panel. It refers to procedure. And we all know that chapter 804 is a procedural chapter.
You know, this is a policy that's used in Wisconsin, right?
That's correct.
The insured are residents of Wisconsin.
Yes, they are.
All right. In fact, the reason I know it's a Wisconsin policy is it persists in referring to Wisconsin statutes. So it refers to Wisconsin 344.01. That's on the first page of the policy. It refers to that statute in other parts of this policy. It refers to particular sections of 344 in this policy. So it the insurance company knows how to refer to statutes if it wants to. And usually it's referring to statutes that favor it, and it says, okay, we want to apply that statute here. And then all of a sudden you talk about the county where the insurer lives, and then you talk about local rules, no reference to Chapter 788, and no references to 804, right?
I grant you that.
So let's just assume that the arbitrators are just dead wrong. They violated BOST. They violated 788. Let's just assume that. What remedy do the Marlowes have?
Well, I'll answer that with the following caveat because of the agreement that was entered into between the attorneys in spite of the language in the contract. But the answer is clear. They go to 788-10, I think it is.
You go to either 10 or 11. One is modification. The other is vacating.
Right. Yeah. And if there's a manifest disregard for the law, and I think that's what your question is getting at, Chief Justice, if there's a manifest disregard for the law by what the arbitration panel has done, then that case has to go back. It should be reversed. But the standard in arbitration is even if a circuit court or an appellate court might have come to a different ruling, they have to grant the discretion of the arbitration panel and give deference to the arbitration panel with respect to their interpretation of the contract. And that's something which in this case, despite that standard, I don't think the circuit court adhered to. And I might add beyond that, and it's mentioned in the briefs, these three attorneys are really experts in the area of personal injury law, and I know all three of them personally. They have 93 years combined experience in handling cases just like this one. I don't think anyone of us, including plaintiff's counsel, is going to select one of those attorneys if they didn't trust their wisdom and judgment when it comes to applying and interpreting the law fairly.
They may be experts in personal injury law, and of course we can't gauge that, and I'm not going to, but I don't know that they're experts in interpreting insurance policies or applying this court's rules.
All I can say, Chief Justice, is
you do the best you can.
You do the best you can because the walls, I was just down in your conference room preparing for this, are full of printed cases and decisions where people have taken different sides
for
time immemorial on insurance.
But questions. If there is manifest disregard of the law and it goes back, isn't that a good ground for review now before we deal with that?
Well, excellent question. And that gets back to what's the goal of arbitration. There are several goals. One is to have a complete hearing in a speedy, inexpensive, and less formal procedure. And if every time somebody comes up with a disagreement, and here's where I strongly disagree with plaintiff's counsel, this isn't the only decision that would come up or the only issue that would come up. And we know that from looking at insurance policies and the thousands of cases that have been litigated over language that everyone, at least at the time, thought was clear in their own respective view. So I guess I've lost my train of thought there, but your question again was?
Well, if there's manifest disregard of the law, and if at the final decision of the arbitrator, the Marlowes lose, then there's manifest disregard of the law and they can go back. Now, if that's what would happen, well, why don't we cut right to the chase? We're interested in the truth. Let's do it now. And also in speaking about the truth, sometimes truth doesn't come out in litigation because parties can't afford litigation at all or only afford to do litigation with only partial discovery or no discovery, right?
I agree.
And IDS doesn't bear their costs.
Does or does not?
IDS doesn't bear the Marlowe's costs of arbitration.
No, that's correct, and that's consistent with the American rule on,
right.
on attorney's fees.
Even though that may be needed for truth.
Well, this same theme came up in earlier questions today. My thought when I heard it is, what keeps the sides honest? Well, in my experience, and I've represented insurance companies for 25 years, they're penurious. They don't want to spend thousands of dollars on a case that doesn't justify it doing unnecessary discovery. They don't want to depose every doctor who has seen or treated or evaluated the plaintiff. They want to depose the only one or the one that they think is going to bring the opinions to trial or is going to have the testimony that might alter the outcome or the value of the case.
Counsel, can I ask you a question before your time's up? And this also pertains to the plaintiff's counsel as well, so I'm not going to ask it twice. But 78806 talks about the authority of an arbitrator to issue a subpoena under 885 or furnish blank forms to do that to a representative for any party. Then the representative can issue a subpoena under 80507. And if someone refuses to obey that subpoena, then it says you can petition the circuit court for a sanction under 785. Walk me through why that doesn't mean discovery disputes can end up back in circuit court. Because a subpoena duces tecum is within that. You can issue a subpoena for a witness to bring documents under 80507. So talk to me about why that doesn't mean if that witness refuses to show up with the documents or refuses to come, that you don't end up in circuit court, since that's what 78806 says.
I think you're probably right, because the insurance contract, if you're looking to that for an answer, isn't going to answer a question about whether a witness is in contempt. You would have to go to the circuit court for that.
Okay, so for example, in your discovery disputes that you have here, assume that you notice up a subpoena duces tecum, and they say, we're not complying. Where do you think you go under 78806?
I think you would have to, as the following statute, 78807, discusses, go to any court of record in that county and petition relief from them.
Okay, so where in there does it say you have to wait till the whole thing is over?
Well, in the case, the example that you're talking about, if it's a critical witness and you can't get that evidence or information anywhere else, I suppose that would be one of the unusual or extraordinary circumstances that especially the federal case law speaks to, where there would be an exception to the general rule that once you begin to arbitrate, you finish the arbitration.
So do you agree or disagree that there isn't exclusive authority for the arbitrator to decide discovery disputes?
I believe they have the exclusive authority to decide discovery disputes within the powers that they're granted. So again, in the example that we're discussing, the contract doesn't talk about giving, especially in the arbitration clause, giving the arbitrators any power to find a witness in contempt. I think you would have to go through the circuit court for that. But there again, that would be one of the unusual or extraordinary circumstances where there would be an exception to the general rule that you would complete the arbitration.
Counsel, as I read the Borst decision, it is all about authority. That is, essentially, the initial question asked was whether or not these arbitrators have any inherent authority to resolve disputes regarding discovery. And I thought Justice Wilcox was quite clear that the answer is, look, these arbitration proceedings are creatures. We create them, and they have no more authority than they're given. And he says that the legislature gave authority in 788, and if you can't find it in 788, then you have to find it in the express intent of the parties by contract.
That's true.
And that's it. You don't have that, according to this opinion, you don't have. So you're not relying on 788. You're relying on the express intent of the parties in the contract. Is that correct?
Right. Those magic words, if you will, that the laws of procedure and evidence, the local laws, would apply.
Let me tell you what one of my concerns is here, and it's the Borst concern. Because in Borst, the court said that unfettered discovery defeats the general purpose of arbitration to be faster, less formal, and less expensive. And they said, we believe unfettered discovery, as the arbitration panel granted to the parties here, is contrary to the goals of arbitration because unfettered can be more costly and more timely. And I don't understand how you can get out of this language in the contract, the only thing that you're relying on, such broad authority, given that it has to be expressed and specific, set forth and Borst. Tell me how you do that.
Well, again, maybe I haven't expressed myself as clearly as I could. If there is an ambiguity, then the next question is submit it to the tribunal who's going to decide that.
And so they decide the scope of their own authority. Is that right, then?
Well, they don't have any inherent authority, which is what you've said and which Borst says. What distinguishes our case from Borst is the fact that we had that language regarding local laws on procedure and evidence. Borst is devoid of that, and that's, I think, the critical distinction when we're trying to apply Borst to a case like this. Another point that you raised in your question was unfettered discovery, and that could go on and on and on. Well, an important fact in Borst is that was a very nominal case. The arbitration panel concluded, I think, the whole case was worth $3,000. So unfettered discovery on a case which is worth $3,000 isn't what we have here, where you have a case with almost no visible damage to a vehicle, more than $60,000 in medical bills. Now lots of questions rein in as to what is the relationship between the two. And I think discovery, using discovery to seek the truth, is the only fair manner in this case to resolve it.
Justice Prosser.
Reflection. Do you think the Borst case in the parts that we're talking about was too narrowly decided?
You know, I don't. My personal opinion was I thought Borst decided what we were here for. Borst clearly says, and in spite of how many times the petitioner wants to ignore the language, Borst clearly says, unless there is other language in the contract regarding procedure or rules, then the arbitration panel has no authority. And I think that applies here. I'm not suggesting Borst is an opposite to the outcome we look for in this case. I think Borst is controlling, and we clearly have an exception to the situation in Borst, because this policy contains that language, and therefore Borst should control.
Well, the state bar, the section on alternative dispute resolution at the time of the Borst decision argued, if arbitration is to function effectively, arbitrators must possess the inherent authority to allow or limit discovery as they see fit. I mean, apparently this court decided directly opposite of what the alternative dispute section wanted. Let me ask this. As I understand it, opposing counsel seems to be saying that a lot of the desired information is obtainable, but only at the actual hearing before the arbitrators, not through discovery. What is your response to that?
I'm glad that question was asked, Justice Prosser, because Wisconsin has had a longstanding rule through, as shown through the statute's governing procedure, that we don't want trials by ambush. We don't want to be learning at the time that the tribunal is making a final determination of what someone is going to say. That's the whole process for discovery, and it's through that process that most cases get resolved. Once each side has a fair idea of the strengths and weaknesses of their own case and their opponent's case, then they can frankly evaluate a case. And hopefully reasonable minds prevail and it gets resolved. If it were otherwise, if my client in this case were prevented from knowing 75 to 90% of the information until the hearing, then they've lost control of the proceeding. Now it's up to an arbitration panel, and maybe 6, 8, 10 months earlier, they could have resolved it had they known that information. I don't think that's a practical or efficient way of doing, of evaluating a personal injury case.
So why would you go to arbitration if there's discovery in arbitration? Why wouldn't both sides say, oh, just go to court, it's easier?
Frankly, Chief Justice, I don't think it is easier. I've handled numbers of cases both in court and in arbitration, and at least in my practice, what I've found, as counsel indicated, is you typically submit everything that you feel is relevant to the arbitration panel in advance. They have a chance to review it, just as you review the briefs and are prepared here. And the only thing else that happens at the hearing, at least in the experience that I've had, is that they take testimony from the plaintiff so they can evaluate their credibility in person. And that's far easier than having to finagle yourself onto a court's calendar, having to educate jurors perhaps on issues that may be complex, when you can hire experts in personal injury where you don't have to go through any of that. You just give them the information, you present some evidence, usually the plaintiff's testimony, and you trust that they will resolve the case fairly because that's what they've been doing for years.
Also, I have a question.
Justice Rogensack?
The employer's case talks about the arbitrator having the decision to interpret the scope of what's arbitrable. And it says that the arbitrator gets to do it unless there is manifest disregard for the agreement. So they're not talking about the law. They're talking about the agreement. As I understand opposing counsel's argument, he is saying they interpret the agreement, but if they don't interpret it in line with his interpretation of Vorst, then they have manifestly disregarded the agreement itself because it must be interpreted according to Vorst. Is that the way you interpret what they are saying? Because it's a different... The Chief Justice asked you a lot of questions about manifest disregard of the law, but the cases talk about manifest disregard of the contract, of the agreement, okay? And as I'm thinking about her questions and opposing counsel's argument, seems to me what he's saying is the arbitrator can only interpret the agreement without manifestly disregarding it if they interpret the agreement under Vorst, and he interprets Vorst one way, you interpret Vorst a different way.
Do you think
I'm on the same page here?
I think I understand the question. We do interpret it differently.
Yeah.
And I believe one of the reasons why review under arbitration is a higher standard than you might have, for instance, just in a de novo review standard, is to protect that discretion of the tribunal.
Right, because if the standard is manifest disregard of the agreement, and that's that scope of arbitration is what employers talk about, so we're deciding whether the arbitrator gets to decide about discovery. And
If there is only one reasonable interpretation of Borst, then opposing counsel must be correct. If there is another reasonable interpretation of Borst, which you are presenting as your argument, then does the arbitrator get to decide which interpretation of Borst is used under this agreement? Am I making any sense here? What's bothering
me? I think the arbitrator does, or the panel does,
mm-hmm.
up until the point that it might get challenged.
Okay.
And then the appellate court, in that instance, would have to look at it and, in giving deference to the arbitration panel, say, is this a close call? Might I have decided it differently, but I still think they're within the parameters of the law?
Yeah.
Or have they completely ignored the contractual language or the parameters of the law in reaching their decision?
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's a big help.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you. You may be seated. We have 5 minutes for the amicus. The Chief Justice had to leave for a meeting, and she wanted me to advise the party she'll be listening to the rest of this argument via video. Or audio.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dustin Brown. I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, appearing as an amicus. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to participate in oral argument today. The issues before the court today transcend the insurance industry. They affect anyone who agrees to arbitrate disputes, regardless of industry or context. As everyone has agreed, all sides benefit when arbitration is efficient. And the alliance is appearing today trying to safeguard that efficiency. The very fact that we're here today discussing a two-year-old discovery dispute illustrates one thing, that this is not efficient. But this is the procedure that this court is going to invite if it does not affirm the Court of Appeals. And this is an approach by which no one is going to benefit. Justice Bradley, in the previous argument you had alluded to, you know, wanting to hear a step-by-step analysis of things. And I think it might be appropriate to go into a step-by-step analysis into how this court would have to rule if it were to overturn the Court of Appeals. We've been spending a lot of time today talking about the meaning of this particular arbitration clause. However, the arbitrators already did that, and they did an excellent job. They, in fact, did such a good job that Justice Rogensack, they anticipated your question about the local rules in Brown County. And there's a standard to be applied for decisions by an arbitration panel. That's manifest disregard. And I've also heard from a number of the justices today that you seem to think that this particular clause was ambiguous. Let's say it is ambiguous. If it is ambiguous, then the manifest disregard standard can't allow you to overturn the arbitration panel's decision. If they're construing an ambiguous provision of the contract, there's no way that's in manifest disregard of the party's intent. There's no way that it's in manifest disregard of the law.
If it's ambiguous, then there is no mutual meeting of the minds in the written word, right?
I mean, if it's ambiguous, then there's not mutual meaning of the mind?
Yeah.
Well, the typical approach to construing a contract is when there's ambiguity, you look beyond the words on the page to try to determine whether or not there is a meaning of the mind. So whether there's a meaning of the mind is a separate issue. You can have an ambiguous provision of the contract and decide based on evidence, based on the fact that the arbitrator is right there working with the parties, being able to ask them questions, and determine that, yes, in fact, there was a meeting of the minds.
Is this language that we're referring to, then, an express statement of mutual intent?
Yes, the fact that the court alluded to an express statement of mutual intent, express doesn't mean that it's not ambiguous. It means that there is some language, direct language, in the contract that you can refer to that addresses this issue. And that raises another question, or another concern, rather, that if this court construes the language of Borst as requiring some kind of heightened standard for construing discovery clauses in arbitration contracts, then that means that all the case law that we have governing the standard that arbitrators are supposed to apply in construing contracts, that goes out the window, and you're creating this new standard that's going to be much more difficult to apply. There is a standard of review for arbitrators' construction of contracts, And when parties agree to arbitrate a dispute, they're actually agreeing to have the arbitrator construe that agreement. And typically, whenever any adjudicator is interpreting an agreement, they're allowed to follow the standard rules of contract construction.
How do you deal with paragraph 57? And let me read it. It's brief. Of the Borst opinion. It says, in our view, arbitrators do not have the inherent authority to determine the necessity and scope of discovery allowed because, quite simply, there's no statutory authority providing for discovery outside the procedures for depositions enumerated in 788.07. And so it has to, then they go on to say, thus it has to be expressed, clear and specific express authority.
Right. Therefore, it has to be in the contract, and here it was in the contract. And then you get back to the same question of who is going to construe the contract. And this court has held, and courts in Wisconsin in general have held, that it's the arbitrator's job to construe the contract, and parties have agreed to have the arbitrator be the individual who is construing the contract.
It seems like a vicious circle here that we're saying that in this contract, the parties have agreed to allow the arbitrator to decide the scope of discovery, the necessity and the scope of discovery. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think it's actually that circular. What the parties have agreed to is for the arbitrator to decide the matter that's before it. And the arbitrators have to construe the arbitration agreement in order to do that. It's not just a question of discovery. Any question of procedure that comes up over the course of the arbitration, somebody has to construe that, and they've agreed that the arbitrator is the person to construe that. And this court follows a manifest disregard standard with respect to reviewing the arbitrator's decision. And given that, again, going back to this assumption that it might be ambiguous, that can't be a manifest disregard. That standard can't be the standard that you follow. I see that my time is up.
Let me ask, are there any other questions, though, before?
When you say manifest disregard, you forget to put, or perhaps on purpose, didn't put, manifest disregard of what?
Of the contract or of the law.
Of the contract or of the law, okay. And if Borst were written a bit differently, and it said in Borst, unless you delineate specifically each item of discovery, then you must stick with the discovery under 788.07.
Mm-hmm.
And the arbitrator determined that all discovery was available as he did here. Would that be manifest interpretation of the contract as it incorporates local rules, or how do you put those together?
I am not following your question.
I know. It's a real. It's one of those things that gets in my mind and bugs me, and it's really hard to put in a question. Some of the questions go to Borst, okay? Mm-hmm. If we didn't have to worry about the contract and we're interpreting just the statute someplace, fine. We could do that, and we'd look at Borst and how does it interpret a particular statute. But we have an arbitration agreement which requires us to interpret the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in some way...
It requires the arbitrators to interpret the contract.
Right, yes. That's right. And my concern is trying to line up Borst with employers.
Mm-hmm.
Employers talks about manifest disregard of the agreement, not of the law. Mm-hmm. Okay, but I think both sides seem to agree that the law can't be transgressed by the agreement. You'd have a illegal contract to some respect, but not in the usual way you would use that term. And what I'm asking you is it your position that the arbitrator always gets to interpret what local rules mean in this contract, regardless of what Borst said, or does Borst permit your interpretation as part of the local rules?
Borst absolutely permits this interpretation. And actually, if you look at some of the specific language in Borst, Borst essentially included what I would characterize as best practices for drafting an arbitration agreement with respect to this issue of discovery. And one piece of advice that the court gave to those drafters is that they should reference a set of established ADR provider rules that specify how discovery is to be handled. That's exactly what this arbitration clause does, with only one difference. Rather than referencing a set of established ADR provider rules, it's referencing the local rules, which include discovery, because if you look at Wisconsin rules of civil procedure under Chapter 804, it explicitly says procedure.
I know, but they didn't say Chapter 804. If they said Chapter 804, we probably wouldn't be here.
Right, except, but this is exactly what the court said that they should do in Borst, because they said to reference rules that specify how discovery is to be handled. This court isn't in the position of rewriting the arbitration contract. You know, we have the arbitration contract that we have. And again, going back to the manifest disregard standard of review, and I urge the court to go back and review the decisions of the arbitration panel. They did a very thorough job. They explicitly referenced Borst in both of their decisions. As soon as the second paragraph, they said Borst governs. And this falls within Borst, and they explained why. So unless doing precisely that is in manifest disregard of the law, then this court can't overturn that decision. And that's exactly the analysis that the Court of Appeals engaged in.
Hold on just a minute. Let me ask, are you still responding to her question?
One short question.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to where I started, finishing the analysis for your benefit, Justice Bradley.
This sounds really basic, but is the term arbitration defined anywhere? I mean, how do you know the sentence, local rules of law as to procedure and evidence will apply, applies to the actual date when the matter is finally arbitrated? Or does it apply to the workup and everything done before the actual date where the matter is arbitrated? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm getting back kind of to my 78806 question. I mean, how is arbitration defined? Is that everything that leads up to the final day when you present your evidence to those three people? Or does that phrase, local rules of law as to procedure and evidence will apply, does that mean on the date of the arbitration, you want the rules of evidence to apply?
Right. I would say that to sort of make an analogy, and a hearing is to an arbitration as a trial is to litigation. If you say arbitration, you're referring to everything, just as when you say litigation, you're referring to everything. Trials themselves are somewhat rare. When you're saying litigation, you're not only referring to trials. Same things with arbitration. It refers to the entire proceeding.
Any other questions? If not, then counsel, thank you.
Thank you very much.
5 minutes has turned into 15, I think, kind of quickly.
Sorry.
And let's see if we can hold this one to five. We'll do it if we can. And if we can, we won't. You may proceed.
Thank you. The a lot of things were discussed here, trying to figure out where to start. IDS had a year and a half after the Borst decision came out before it issued this policy to the Marlowes. The Borst decision tells them exactly how they should write their policy if, in fact, they wanted to be able to conduct discovery beyond Chapter 788 in their policy. It had to be clearly drafted. It had to detail the necessary components and procedures. If they had wanted unfettered discovery, or if they had wanted Chapter 804 discovery in their policy, all they had to do was say so by amending their policy to comply with Borst. Borst essentially was the blueprint for them. The discussion about the ambiguity in this clause goes back to the Court of Appeals decision, because the Court of Appeals decision inserts language into the Borst decision by saying if it arguably refers to discovery, then that's okay. Then we'll let the arbitrators determine the scope of discovery, but that's not what Borst said. So when we talk about arguability ambiguity, those are things that are a measure that tell us that clearly the language of this policy did not contain the type of language that this court directed drafters of arbitration clauses to consider if they wanted to go beyond Chapter 788. But in addition, if it is, again, ambiguous, or if it only arguably refers to discovery, nobody could say that that thus is a clearly drafted agreement. By definition, it doesn't cut the mustard of being a clearly drafted agreement if it is ambiguous. The Wisconsin Insurance Alliance suggested that the standard of manifest disregard somehow plays a role here. My understanding is that's a standard when you're seeking an intermediate review of an arbitrator's decision. Here, again, this is a very fact-specific case that this court decided in Bors. It doesn't deal with the authority of arbitrators generally to make decisions. It deals with the arbitrator's authority to determine the scope of discovery. It's the empowering language that they need either by statute or they need it by contract. And again, Bors says if it isn't clearly and expressly stated in the contract, the only thing they get under statute is Chapter 788. So we did not seek intermediate review of the decision on discovery because what we were talking about is an interpretation of the insurance policy language to see whether it was adequate under the direction of Bors.
Counselor, employers states appellate courts uphold an arbitrator's contract interpretation if the arbitrator's interpretation drew its essence from the contract so that it was not a manifest disregard of the party's agreement. Now, the arbitrators focused on the same words we've all been talking about, these local rules. If I understand your argument, you're saying that they simply interpreted the phrase wrong. But unless there's only one reasonable way of reading Borst, I'm not sure how that fits within employers and all the cases that are cited under it.
Well, keep in mind that employers was cited by this court in Borst. It was decided 10 years before Borst, so I don't think it was meant to be definitive of the specific issue, again, of determining scope of discovery with arbitrators. That's Borst. We're talking generally in employers.
Well, we're talking here about the arbitrator's interpretation of the agreement. I mean, that's why we're all talking about these words, local rules. You don't find those in Borst. So the arbitrator, the panel, I keep saying arbitrator, but the panel interpreted the agreement. That's what they did. And I guess at least the way your argument sounds to me, and you can change my mind on this. Obviously, I'm having some difficulty with it, but it sounds to me like in order for you to prevail, I have to conclude the arbitrator could not have interpreted those rules under Bors to mean Chapter 804, right?
I'm not certain that's exactly right.
Okay, well, you can fix it for me, okay?
But I think it goes back again to, okay. We have to look at the rationale and the reasoning and the policy behind Bors, because Bors is a different animal altogether than all of these other cases that deal with authority of arbitrators. We're not challenging across the board an arbitrator's authority to interpret certain provisions of the arbitration agreement in order to conduct the arbitration proceeding. What we're saying is if Bors means anything, if Bors is meant to protect the integrity of arbitration and keep it as a cost-effective, time-efficient means of resolving civil disputes to take pressure off of the circuit courts, then we have to give the language of Bors the meaning that this court meant it to have. And that is that unless they either have a contract provision that clearly and expressly says it, or it's empowered by statute, they don't have the authority to conduct discovery because that goes beyond the policy that this court has indicated was the basis for the Boris decision. So I think if we try to mix Boris with all of the other cases that talk about authority, it doesn't sound rational. But when you consider the public policy behind Boris, then it makes sense. It was something this court had to do to make certain that we don't have cases where somebody on one side wants to conduct 100 depositions and run somebody into the ground in a proceeding in an arbitration clause of a purchase agreement where there's an unequal bargaining power. It has to say it in the agreement if they're going to do that type of thing. Otherwise, there's too much risk. It's going to cause people to shy away from arbitration. It'll cause people to either not pursue their claims or perhaps go to circuit court. And, of course, circuit court is going to be more time-consuming and costly for everybody.
I think your answer to my question was yes.
Okay. I'll stand by my answer. I see that my time is up.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you, counsel. Thanks to all of you for your great arguments here today. I know the entire court enjoyed them, as I did. And we are in recess until later. Thank you.